One of the attacks that the living constitutionalists have waged against this revival of original understanding of the Constitution is that we never can understand the true intent of the founders.
I am always skeptical that we can know what was the original intent behind a constitutional provision.
Well, that's not what originalism is. It's not what their subjective, unspoken intent was. It's what they conveyed by the words they used to the people who would then subsequently vote to ratify the Constitution or the amendments.
I'm also skeptical that even if we knew, it should be binding on us today.
If the words no longer mean anything, then we don't have a Constitution that binds and limits the power of government, and government can do whatever they want.
The Commerce Clause. It's 16 words and two commas. They're not even hard words. Most people can figure out what it means. Sadly, Congress is not most people.
Well, I would assume it would be in the Commerce Clause. That's how Congress legislates all kinds of programs.
Is your answer that they can do anything?
The federal government, yes, can do most anything in this country.
Now, I don't worry about the Constitution on this, to be honest.
Jackpot, brother.
What was originally intended to be a restriction on states has been rewritten into a grant of virtually unlimited power to Congress. How did we get here?
What is meant by the term commerce?
The world is so different now from what it was in 1787. But I think that what the framers intended with the Commerce Clause was give Congress broad authority to regulate all aspects of the economy.
Really? All aspects of the economy?
Commerce at the time of the founding meant trade. You had manufacturing, that was not commerce. You had agriculture, that was not commerce. You had retail sales, that was not commerce.
The issue involves the economic welfare of the United States, but it also involves the balance of power between the federal government and the government of the states.
Regulating commerce among the states meant regulating the trade. So a state couldn't impose trade barriers, which often were the precursor to war.
The Commerce Clause was created to quash the commercial warfare that threatened to break the states apart. And for over 100 years, Congress exercised the commerce power only in that way, preventing interference with interstate commerce. But the Great Depression, the New Deal, and FDR's court packing plan put substantial pressure on the courts to accept dramatically expanded federal powers. To justify new laws, the court seized on a few lines from an 1824 court case.
The case known as Gibbons versus Ogden.
Marshall wrote a fairly narrow opinion. Well, because his formulation said that commerce which does not have a substantial effect on other states. And they've picked up on that rhetoric.
And the Supreme Court very broadly defined the scope of Congress's commerce power.
And now said, well, anything that does have a substantial effect on commerce.
Any activity that affects more than one state?
Can be regulated by Congress, which was not Marshall's intent at all.
Where are you leading us, Mr. Marshall?
And then all of a sudden, you get Wickard versus Filburn, which is probably the broadest, most expansive interpretation ever given to the Commerce Clause.
Roscoe Filburn grew wheat on his farm for his own home consumption. His entire crop was fed to his livestock, consumed by his family, or stored for planting in the next year. The wheat was never bought, never sold, and never left the state.
So he was deliberately not engaging in interstate commerce.
And yet the Supreme Court ruled that his crop could be regulated under the authority of the Interstate Commerce Clause. Because if everyone grew their own wheat, no one would buy any.
Their failure to engage in commerce would have a substantial effect on commerce, and therefore Congress could regulate it.
Congress can regulate any activity that taken cumulatively has a substantial effect on interstate commerce.
And of course, that turns the Commerce Clause upside down. And it's no longer a power to regulate interstate commerce, it's a power to regulate everything. Wickard is wrongly decided, and it needs to be overturned.
In the wake of the New Deal, the Commerce Clause continued to expand into all aspects of American life. From 1937 to 1995, not a single piece of legislation was struck down as exceeding the scope of Congress's Commerce Clause authority.
And then the court decided United States versus Lopez.
The issue at hand was the Gun-Free School Zones Act.
The statute prohibited possession of a gun within 100 yards of a school. Now, nobody supports possession of a gun within 100 yards of school. Texas had a law against that, in fact. The question is whether it was in the federal government's authority.
For the majority, the relationship to interstate commerce was too attenuated.
There was no interstate commerce connection to that statute, and they struck it down. They don't explicitly overrule Wickard versus Filburn, even though the reasoning of the case cannot be squared with Wickard versus Filburn. Well, the opportunity confronts them to address that in the medical marijuana case out of California.
Angel Raich grew and consumed medical marijuana in her home, which was legal under California's Compassionate Use Act, but illegal under federal law.
It's like the homegrown wheat case. This should have been a judgment left to California.
The court said, producing a crop that's bought and sold in interstate commerce, albeit illegally for marijuana, is economic activity.
That reaffirms Wickard versus Filburn and largely repudiates the Commerce Clause revolution of Lopez.
So just how powerful is the Commerce Clause? We may find out soon.
A number of states have challenged the Obamacare, the nationalized health care bill that came out this past year. And the first challenge is on Commerce Clause grounds.
The question revolves around the individual mandate.
And that's why under my plan, individuals will be required to carry basic health insurance.
Congress can force economic transactions. In the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the court said hotels and restaurants can be forced under Congress' commerce power to serve or rent to African Americans, even if they don't want to. Requiring people to have health insurance meets the rational basis test. Just like every court has said, it meets rational basis review to require that all drivers have car insurance.
Everybody in America just about has to get auto insurance.
Well, there's a huge difference. The act of driving is not a constitutional right, it's a privilege. And so we can impose conditions on the exercise of that privilege under the state's police power. Living is not a privilege, but it's a right. And I can't impose a condition on the mere act of living, which is what the Obamacare mandate does. If you don't follow the mandate and buy the insurance policy that the government orders you to buy, then you get taxed.
You might call this a penalty.
Government is going through contortions trying to say it's not a tax.
Nobody considers that a tax increase.
Well, if it's not a tax, they don't have authority to do it, so they have to say it is a tax.
One reason that the government may want to call it a tax for purpose of litigation is it's clear that you can't argue that a tax is an unconstitutional taking of private property without just compensation.
But if it is a tax, it does two things. It violates President Obama's pledge that he wouldn't raise taxes.
You can't just make up that language and decide that that's called a tax increase.
And it's a tax not tied to income. That means it's a direct tax. And the Constitution's very clear. Direct taxes have to be apportioned according to population. Well, this would be apportioned according to whether you bought the policy or not, not according to population. And it's invalid under Article 1 of the Constitution.
I think the Supreme Court will uphold this. I think it may never go to the Supreme Court. If my prediction is right, the courts of appeals will uphold this as constitutional.
The Supreme Court's going to have to take it. It's too big a deal for an intermediate appellate court to have the final say on it.
So where is the limit of congressional power under the Commerce Clause?
The limit is the extent of the creativity of the members of Congress.
If I wanted to sponsor a bill and it said, Americans, you have to eat 3 vegetables and 3 fruits every day, does that violate the Commerce Clause?
Sounds like a dumb law.
Do we have the power to tell people what they have to eat every day?
In her view of the Constitution, there's nothing that Congress can't do. All she said was, oh, that would never happen. That's a foolish law. She never said it would be unconstitutional.
I think what people choose to eat well might be regarded as a personal liberty.
The government can force you to eat 3 meals a day, eat McDonald's hamburgers, not eat McDonald's hamburgers.
What we put into our bodies really is part of our freedom. But there's not a freedom to not have medical care.
Buy General Motors cars instead of Toyota cars.
In theory, Congress could use its commerce power to require people to buy cars. In reality, it's a ridiculous hypothetical.
All sorts of things that the government now compel you to do if the individual mandate is upheld.
Power can be used in silly ways, and the Constitution isn't our protector against undesirable government actions, only unconstitutional ones.
And ultimately, the fight over the scope of the Commerce Clause is about that. Do we have a government that is limited in purpose and in its powers to do only the things that we, the sovereign people, gave it to do for certain designated purposes? Or is it an amorphous, unlimited government that can do to us whatever it wants?
What have we got? A republic or a monarchy?
A republic, if you can keep it so.